Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hey, and welcome back. My name is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week's guest is Rick Alexander. Rick is a former Navy Special Ops combat medic. He's the author of the book, Burn Your Couch, A Manifesto for the Average Averse, and he's the host of Lionheart Radio. Rick is a guy that I really aspire to be more like. He's super adventurous, driven, and goal-oriented, and yet he is going through life very consciously and making sure that he's doing things that are truly authentic to him rather than things that he thinks he should do or thinks other people want of him. We talk about choosing comfort over happiness and how often it is that we fall into this trap in our lives. We talk about experiences that have shaped his perspective on life. He's a really, emotionally intelligent and deep person, and I gave him props on the show because I think that's really uncommon, especially in the military, to have both of those polarities, to be a warrior on one end and yet have the emotional depth and softness or gentleness that he has. And we talk about how you can use some of the lessons that he's learned. We talk about how to get clarity on what you want in life. We talk about how to overcome the need for external validation in the things we do and not be so constrained by what other people want of us or what we think we should do. We talk about ultra running and some hallucinations that he's had. And he has a hilarious story of fighting ninjas while running. And finally, we talk about something he calls the bucket list blueprint, which is a way of goal setting, like long-term goal setting and setting up your life in a way that you are doing the things that you really, really want to do. This one was a pleasure for me. Rick was vulnerable and open and shared some really meaningful stories to him, and we went in a lot of good directions. I hope you enjoy the show. Rick, what's up, brother? How are you?
Not too much. How are you doing? I'm doing well.
Awesome, man. Yeah, I'm doing great as well. The weather's clearing up here in Austin. It's starting to cool off. I'm midway through a heavy podcast day and excited to be here with you, man.
Yeah, likewise. I we were just talking pre-show about moving to Colorado and everybody's sending me like snaps and everything from Colorado now. And God, it's already like sweater weather. Some of the mountains have already got snow. I'm getting real excited for it.
Nice, dude. All right, man, let's get into this. So your first book that you wrote is called Burn Your Couch, A Manifesto for the Average Averse. And one of the main themes in the book is kind of overcoming the mistake that a lot of people make, which is choosing comfort or mistaking comfort for happiness. And I think you have a funny story about running to work where this kind of imprinted in your mind. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I think sometimes a lot of the lessons, at least that I have, are sort of forged in difficult moments, and like aha moments typically have come from these difficult moments, which I guess goes to reinforce the whole idea to begin with. But so for a while I was building a supplement company on the side. I was also active duty in the military, which I spent about 10 years special operations in the military. And I was an instructor at the Bud Schoolhouse. So, 200 students every 8 weeks we had that were trying to be SEAL or SWCC. And so my job there consisted of working until about noon, and then maybe 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon, we had a good schedule. And so then I would go to my office, which was on the complete opposite end of town, where I would try to build my company. And it was interesting at the time because I was sort of, anybody that spent a lot of time trying to build a company, even if it's in the health industry, knows that sometimes we have a tendency to neglect our health in that moment, in that trying to do something and build something. We don't prioritize our health for whatever reason. And so I was sort of in that moment where I'd been spending 5-6 months really neglecting my own health, and just sort of in this routine of getting up early, going to gyms, doing tastings, going to work, and then going to my office, trying to build the company. And so it occurred to me like this sort of inability was like rubbing me the wrong way, that I was like, I could tell that I was getting just not as sharp as I should be. You know, like one of the things that happens with health, obviously everybody that listens to this knows the mental clarity you get from working out. And so that's when I really started to notice it. I was like not feeling as sharp. And I just kept paying attention to my drive from where I would drop myself off at my apartment, and then I'd drive to my office after work. And it was about 13, 14 miles. But at the moment, like in that moment in time, even though now I run a lot of ultras and stuff, at the time, I hadn't run for 5 or 6 months probably. But I realized like, oh man, on Wednesdays, I get off early enough. I could probably run there if I really wanted to. And I just over time, that sort of got the best of me. And then eventually I went for it. So it's like 13 hilly miles through San Diego, super hot. And just because of my own deconditioning, like the actual run itself was pretty, pretty rough.
Yeah.
I like had to stop. I like wanted to stop at Jack in the Box. Like I was really falling apart there in the middle of it. And we had a sales meeting that night. And so I'm sitting around with everybody and I'm like, my legs keep cramping up. So I have to keep standing away from the table. My feet are cramping up and I'm disgusting. Like I'm covered in road grime. And at the same time, I was driving a Mercedes and it was parked in my driveway. And I realized that whole meeting, I just couldn't wipe this like shit eating grin off my face. Like I was just so, I guess it was happy, but I was just so content with the work that I had done, even though it was so rough. And so I just sort of had this aha moment that it's like, oh, holy crap, like the most comfortable vehicle I've ever owned in my life, parked in my garage, had nothing to do with my day today. And in fact, the reason that I'm so happy to be sitting in this meeting was because of the contrast, because I didn't have that thing. You know, every other day I drove that car to that meeting and I didn't feel that contentment. And so it was sort of an aha moment of like, wow, how many times in our life do we make decisions to get comfortable and realize that hoping that the end result is happiness, mm-hmm. but it's not, right? It's just this sort of low grade emptiness that we are always trying to get around. And so this idea that in Western culture, we're always mistaking being comfortable with being happy is sort of the pervasive theme throughout my book. But yeah, that was the moment that I was like, oh shit, these aren't related at all.
Right. Yeah. It's a double-edged sword, right? Like we, if you asked any of us to get rid of our warm clothes or air conditioning or cars or whatever it may be, I don't think many people would give those things up. But there's also on the other side of the coin, they're constraining in a lot of ways, right? They teach us to be, or they make us weaker in a lot of ways. They make us rely on them and forget how to use our bodies. Where do you think this comes from? Is it just like great marketing from capitalism?
I do. Yeah. I mean, essentially, yes. I think that, you know, anybody that's an entrepreneur knows the way that you build a good business is you serve a need. And so now we've had this capitalistic society for so long, which I'm in favor of essentially, but as a consumer, you can't just gobble everything up with reckless abandon because every single need is being met. And, you know, people talk about it a little bit around here or on different podcasts before, but the impact of something like Amazon, if you really think about it, you know, a couple hundred thousand years ago, this is feeding yourself was an act of life or death. Mm-hmm. And it was something that wasn't, you could not take it for granted. It was something that we had to spend a lot of time putting our energy into doing. Well, now that same act can literally be done with an app on your phone with Prime Now, right? Through Whole Foods. And you can get essentially, you know, the same kind of food if you want to. And so I just don't think that a lot of people don't put that connection together. Like the real significance of that gets lost on people. But, you know, I think that it's something that we should pay attention to more because all of these times of discomfort are actually the times you're going to look back on your life and remember.
Do you think that discomfort is necessary?
Necessary to what?
For happiness.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's only happiness is only achievable with the contrast.
I agree. Ironically, I think I read this in the Unabomber manifesto, the manifesto that he sent to the Washington Post. Have you ever heard or read about that?
I have not read it though. I need to actually.
It's fascinating. And in there, he talks about what you just mentioned, which is, you know, we spent a significant amount of effort to get food. And that was a huge part of our fulfillment in life, right? We have a goal, we have the autonomy to reach that goal or to strive towards that goal in our way, and then we get to reach that goal. And that's what they call the power process. And it's what creates fulfillment, and fulfillment, we think, leads to happiness, right? But today, the whole process of getting food is, for the vast majority of people in the West, it's something that we don't even have to work at all for, right? We have to put zero effort because we can just get on welfare and we can get our food still through an app, you know?
Yeah, I mean? Right.
And so I don't know where I was going with this, but.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things, the Bombers Manifesto, but one of the interesting things about that is, you know, back when we were hunter and gatherers, feeding yourself, just trying to exist was meaning. Like it lent itself to meaning because we were kicking and clawing and fighting our way to the top of the food chain. And the problem is that now we've made existing so easy. Like we've essentially so many safety nets, at least I'm talking for Western culture specifically. You'll get just that, you'll exist. And unfortunately that no longer lends itself to meaning because there's no striving in that process anymore. There's no need to level up. There's no need to be a different kind of human in order to just exist anymore.
Exactly. And so anybody listening to this, it means you have like a smartphone or some kind of expensive piece of technology that allows you to listen to this podcast, and you fall into that group. Existence is almost just a given, right?
Right.
The government doesn't even allow us to... they just have so many supports for our health and longevity that it's super easy today to exist. And so we have to create meaning in our lives. And so how have you done that? How have you created meaning in your life?
You know, for me personally, it's been a lot of trial and error, but I think it comes down to, everybody talks about this idea of goal setting, but nobody really talks about the significance of setting a big goal. One of the things that happens, that I'm sort of explaining in one of my newer books, is this idea of how a flow state is achieved, right? Typically, a flow state is achieved when we are rooted in what we understand, yet we're simultaneously exploring that which we don't yet understand, right? And I think if you make the perfect goal for your life, it should be something like a flow state. You don't want it to be so big that you have essentially no chance of achieving it, because then you find yourself in chaos. You don't really know which direction to go, right? But it can't be so small that you achieve it really quick, because the goal is never about the goal. And I think that's what people don't think about. We always want to like skip to the end and just get there because I want to get this goal. But what you don't realize is even when you attain that thing, you're just going to have the need to do something else, because the goal is not about the goal. It's about who you become in that process. And so I think for me personally, like it's been this, and which is why I found ultra marathon running and strength sports and all these different things, because they allow me to find these goals that force me to, and entrepreneurship's the same way, that force me to level up in order to achieve them. And so for me, that's sort of been the process.
It's about setting meaningful goals. Like if I achieve X, then that is a meaningful process to go through. That's a meaningful journey to be on. Is it something like that?
Yeah. So I spent the longest period of my life just trying to achieve goals for the sake of achieving goals. And then I sort of went through this point when I was like 30 years old, about, over a year ago now, but where I got everything that I had wanted. On paper, it was the most successful year of my life. And I was just completely miserable and I could not figure out why. And that's what I meant by trial and error. It's like, at first I was setting all these goals of things to be like, I want to be the guy that writes a book and runs 200 miles and does all this. And now when I approach goal setting, I approach it with the mindset of who am I going to become in the process of trying to achieve this goal?
Yeah, I love that. I love that. So you were in the military for 11 years and you were in special forces. And I've talked to you, or I've heard you talk about living kind of a sort of rock star lifestyle where you traveled to over 50 countries and you just got to do a lot of very exciting things. And then somewhere along the way, I know you lost your one of your best friends in deployment. Can you tell us about that story and kind of the impact that it had on you at that time?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and when I say like I was living this rock star lifestyle, I don't mean that to diminish the difficult times of being in the military, because there are tons of difficult times. You know, I'm super lucky. I got to transition with all my arms, legs, my cognitive ability for the most part. I'm not too screwed up. But yeah, so I guess it was in 2009 now. My roommate, best friend, like we'd gone through boot camp together. We actually had different jobs. He was Explosive Ordnance Disposal, EOD, which is another special operations brand in the Navy. Me and him went through opposite different training pipelines. We stayed in contact. He was from Mass, I'm from Maine. So we would see each other's family on Christmas. I mean, we just became really close, lived together. Ended up moving both to Virginia Beach once we got through our respective pipelines. And then on his very first deployment, he was deployed with SEAL Team 10. Yeah, so there was a moment. I was at that time in my life, I had already made it. I'd already been through deployment. And, you know, one of the things that happens is you sort of get in this rhythm of coming home, raging, drinking a ton, doing just kind of partying and then going back on. It's a very fast lifestyle. And then you go back out the door and you sort of get in this rhythm of doing that. And I was in this rhythm of doing that. And I had just gotten home. I was home for like 2 weeks and my best friend had just left. And then we had found out that he was killed by an IED in Iraq. And at the time, you know, there are certain moments that happen to us in our lives where it sort of just shakes us to the core. And all of a sudden, we don't necessarily understand not only who we are, and like nothing in the world makes sense anymore. So we don't know who we are in relation to the rest of the world. And up until then, I had all of these different beliefs. I had religious beliefs. I had beliefs about the military. Just from growing up, I had been instilled with all of these beliefs. And when you come face to face with tragedy, one of the things that happens is you realize you no longer understand anything about the world and about yourself. And so, I mean, in significance to my own life, you know, a lot of the things that I do now are veteran charities, raising money for people that have lost family members, simply because I've seen the complete devastation that it causes within families.
Yeah.
You know, but the significance that it had in my own life is it started this really, really long process of just self-discovery and figuring out who I really was and what I really wanted. And truthfully, when you have to find that through tragedy, you're going to take a lot of wrong roads. And I did, you know, I took a lot of I spent months just doing nothing but diving into being drunk every single day.
Wow.
I did not handle it well, but when I look back, it's like, you're doing the best you can, man. You know, like sometimes we just have to give ourselves time sometimes there's nothing left to do, but to endure and just get through the storm and try to figure out who you are on the other end of it. And that was the process that I took. I wrote about it in the book a little bit, actually. That's kind of how I ended the book. It definitely, there were some ups and some downs, but it caused me to climb a lot. Because I had to really figure out who I was and what I believed about the world, because I had beliefs that no longer make sense. Like in psychology, they call it coherence. You're always looking for coherence within your worldview. 1 + 1 + 1 should always equal 3. And so when one of the things that happens when tragedy happens, all of a sudden it doesn't anymore. And so now, you know, it could be profoundly destabilizing. It takes years to find that coherence again and find a worldview that actually makes sense and works and is productive for your life, so you don't just spiral down into nowhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know if you meant it that way or not, but my second book is actually about that worldview.
Right. So does one belief come to mind that, you know, you thought was true about the world and then realized wasn't true?
Yeah. And this is it's a deeply personal belief. And I realize everybody has their own sort of philosophical ideas about this, but I spent a lot of my life believing that the universe was completely indifferent to me. So everything was just, the world's just spinning, man. You can do whatever you want. And then I heard somebody say nothing in this life happens to you. It always happens for you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I realized is if you spend enough time trying to figure out what that reason might be, that's not insignificant, because that's your way out of these difficult times. And so I would say the biggest, you know, I think everything matters personally. I think every thought you have, every interest you have, every interaction you have, it all matters. And the good news about having a worldview is you can assign that meaning to it. You know, like you can decide whether the world's indifferent to you or whether it's not. But you also have to decide which one is going to be the most productive for your life. And so I figured I've come to the realization that everything's always, you know, the universe is always kind of inviting you to come be the best version of yourself. You just have to be open to those invitations. Not sure if you were trying to get that deep with it.
Fire. That's okay. Great, man. Always inviting you to be the highest version of yourself. That is phenomenal. And we just have to be open enough to see those opportunities, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So if you're not open to it, then, you know, one of the things about a worldview is whatever yours is, you're probably right.
Right.
You know, it's like, I think it was like that Henry Ford quote, whether you believe you can or you can't, you're right. It's like, yeah, completely. If you believe that that interaction had no significance whatsoever, you're probably right. But yeah, if you can assign meaning to it, it might be inviting you to be a better version of yourself. You just have to explore that option.
Right. So you have you seem to have a level of emotional depth and self-awareness that is really uncommon, especially I think in the military. And So does it come from some of these negative experiences? Where does this come from? Because I know a lot of people in the military have gone through traumatic events and don't have this level of awareness and depth to them. Where does it come from?
Well, I've always been a pretty cerebral person. I've always been the kind of person that wants to understand things. And then on top of that, I've always been the kind of person that's pretty much not willing to accept the first answer, the readily given answer. Like, I think a lot of times society's like, you should want this and you should want this, and this is what success looks like. And I've always kind of been the person, maybe because I'm just deeply rebellious, to be like, why? Why is that what my life has to look like? And so I think, you know, there are answers that are available to people in life, but you have to be willing to go layers deeper. You have to be willing to ask why. So many times it makes people around you uncomfortable, and it will, because people don't want you to question, you know, they don't want you to question the status quo.
Hey guys, I get asked a lot what our most downloaded podcasts are, because we have almost 200 shows recorded and people don't want to take the time to sift through and find the best ones. They want to know what's the best one in X, Y, or Z category. And so what I did is created a little document of the top 5 most downloaded shows, and we put a little write-up with each one of them. So each one of them comes with a high-level overview of what the show is about, as well as some of the biggest actionable items, like the biggest takeaways from each show. And you can get free access to this by going to brutestrengthtraining.com/TOP5. That's top 5. brutestrengthtraining.com/top5. So it's the top 5 most downloaded podcast, as well as the biggest takeaways for each. Enjoy. So I want to talk about a couple different things in your book. And the first is, you believe that we really know who we are deep down, but we're distracted by different inputs and ideas and other people. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, one of the experiences that I had probably 6 months ago, I went out on this trip that was 5 days completely unplugged. They didn't allow you to have your cell phone. And they did a lot of guiding meditation about trying to figure out what you want in life and some of the, you know, kind of woo-woo type things. But one of the things that I came away from that experience and realizing is, for the first 2 or 3 days, I felt nothing but resistance. I was like, I wanted my phone. I wanted to check my emails. I wanted to look at Instagram. Like, you know, we spend so much time mindlessly doing those things that when they're taken away, we have this like anxiety about it. But then after about 72 hours, one of the exercises the instructor kept doing is he would say, okay, he would walk us through a completely picturing our perfect life. Where do we live? Who are we married to? What is our job? What are we driving? Like, as many details as we could possibly give, that's what he was asking for. And I remember the first couple of days, me being like, I don't know. If I knew, I'd have it, right? And then one of the things I realized is after about 72 hours, I actually did know. Like, I could actually picture it. And so I think one of the things that happens in 2018 is we're exposed to so many inputs all the time, so many notifications, that we're just, it's not quiet enough for us to get in touch with what we really, really want for ourselves. And so a lot of times people are like, I don't know how to figure out what I want. And it's like, yeah, because you have to get much quieter in order to do that. I was just lucky to be put in a situation where it forced it. And then I realized the importance of it.
Yeah, I think a lot of us go through, well, all of us are lost in complete thought for a lot of our lives. And it's not until we get out of thinking and get out of feeling that we are actually just being who we are. And we need to get in that space of just being to start to have, to create a vision of what we actually want in life. And it takes some separation from outside input and other people's opinions and all of those things to really drop into that space.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, one of the things that I point to is in the book is this idea that a lot of times when people feel truly aligned with the thing that they're doing, they know finally that they're doing the thing on this earth they should be doing. They look back at all of these other life experiences and they're like, realize that they had been preparing for that moment for their entire lives. And it's because deep down your highest self knows exactly what you should be doing. I look at that the same way with writing. Like I was always writing, even on my off time in the military, I would take assignments where I got to write more. And it's like, yeah, you're not listening to your higher self. You're texting and you're on Instagram and you're sending emails. But because that's one of the things that makes me realize it's like, you know, you've been preparing for this your entire life.
That's why I think one of the most powerful rituals you can have is a journal practice, either like first thing you get up or if you meditate right after you meditate. So that one, you know, when you wake up, you don't have a ton on your mind from the day before. A lot of times you have a cleaner slate than usual. And especially if you're into meditation, you can really kind of silence the distraction a little bit. And then you can start to just express what's going on in your mind and start to see concretely what's going on in there and start to expand on it. Because it's one thing to think certain thoughts, but we don't usually allow ourselves to like go down a rabbit hole and really see what's inside of us. And I think a journal practice in that type of environment and setting allows us to have more insights about what we actually want and, you know, how we're living our lives.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you. One of the things I always say is I read to make sense of the world or to understand the world, but then I write to understand my world. Ooh, because like one that. Of the things that happens when you start writing, especially I found it same with you in the morning when I do a lot of stream of consciousness writing, I'll get done with 1,000-1,500 words and I'll be like, I didn't even know that before I wrote it. Like, where did that just come from? Exactly. And so that's that idea that you're just excavating these deeper thoughts and making sense of them. And that's how you find coherence. Like I was talking about earlier, you have to work through these things that you're always thinking about somehow.
So those of you who haven't heard of this, he just said a term, stream of consciousness writing. That just means to open a book and write whatever comes to your mind. And it can be for some people say 3 pages, some people say 20 minutes, some people say write until you start editing your thoughts. Just write whatever comes to mind. It's a super powerful way to write and to get some insights. So something else that I know you're working on is having confidence in the direction that you're heading in life. And this is a quote that I got from you. Oftentimes, when we don't get the validation we seek from an endeavor, it's easy to want to turn around and abandon ship. In many ways, all of life is just about trying to deal with all of the things that make us want to abandon the ship. This is gold. How did you learn this?
Because I was getting out of over a decade in special operations in the military and telling people I wanted to be a writer. And that's just like you mentioned, like that is not something that you see. Like that is, it's just different, right? And so I had to come to grips with the fact that even though I had this perfect idea of exactly who I wanted to be in the world might not yet understand that. And a lot of times it's not their job. A lot of times applause just waits on success. It's our job to just continue pursuing the thing. And then the reason I wrote about validation is because sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll pull something out of my book and I'll post it on Instagram for say, and it won't get that much. For whatever reason, it just won't land and it won't get a ton of likes, right? And that turns your art into this like quid pro quo thing where you're always sort of you want something for what you're doing. But the reality is that these thoughts and ideas that you're having, the thing that you're doing in the world, has taken an entire lifetime to come up with. And you're really starting to cheapen it when you start to ask for validation. Because there's a dog with an underbite that's got like 6 million followers on Instagram.
Right.
And so it's just not a really good metric for success. And so to compare, you know, the thing that you want to do in the world most with, or to use that kind of metric to validate it, is just, it's not a good idea. And you're going to end up turning around prematurely, I think.
Do you have a good example of a time when you've exercised this like kind of mental trick where you did something, you didn't get the validation that you expected, and how you overcame that and stayed on path?
Yeah. So I gave a talk a couple of months ago. I gave this talk about sort of finding a worthy struggle in life. And when you give a talk, you can tell the tension in the room. You can tell if you're landing, and you can, like, it's palpable, right? You know, the sort of energy that's being reciprocated. Mm. And it was one of those moments where I just felt like I could not get in the groove. I just felt like I could not connect with the audience. But I have this idea about my life that if I've been given, because I told you in my worldview, every thought, every interest, everything matters. And so it's like, for me, I'm like, if I've been given this thought to create this content and put this out into the world, it's my job to do that. I'm just sort of the vessel. Now I got to leave it up to the universe to, you know, let that shit land where it needs to land. And I can't worry too much about that part. Now, you want to perfect your craft. You want to work hard to make sure that the things that you're doing, you're holding a standard for yourself. But like one of those nights, I got off the stage and I just remember thinking, like, what are you doing? Like, stop doing what you're doing because you're not good at it. And it was like all of these self-doubts were just creeping in. And it was the first time I had delivered that talk. So that was, you know, kind of a problem too. And then 48 hours later, I got this super long email from this girl about how she had cancer and her husband left and she had two kids and she didn't know what she was going to do for work. And it was the longest, most heartfelt email I've maybe ever got in my life. And I remember thinking in that moment that I was right. That I have a thought or an idea. It's my job to put it into the world if I feel like I've been called to do something. Just like everybody that's listening to this, if you feel like you've been called to do something, it's your job to put it out into the world. And you got to let the universe sort of sort out where that lands. And I remember thinking in that moment, like, okay, like you got work to do. You got to work on your talk. You got to work on the energy. But for all of the things that went wrong, that made it completely worth it.
That's like the gold standard of validation right there. That's the real form of validation, when someone thanks you for having an impact with the content that you put out, with the words.
Yeah, completely. Because it's super cliche, but like, I mean, at the end of the day, everything in this life is a sandcastle. It's all going away. Everything we do, you and I, we're both going to be going to the same place. We're both gone.
You mean the third tier of heaven?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the astral plane. No, I just mean that, you know, there's nothing we're going to do in this lifetime that's permanent, not to us anyway, because we're all going to die.
Yep.
And so in a lot of ways, the only two things that we have in this life are the moment right now. And how much time do we spend, like I said, wanting to get to the goal, like wanting to avoid that moment, which is unfortunate when it's the only thing we're promised. And the only other thing we have is each other. And how we make each other feel. And so even though it sounds super cliche, we're wired for servitude. We're wired to help each other out, which is why, you know, when you post something on Instagram and you get a like, you get dopamine release. And then that dopamine is fleeting and it causes you to want more, just like cocaine does. And then when you do something really nice for somebody, the predominant hormone that's released in your body is serotonin. And that serotonin is linked to long-term contentment and happiness. Because we're wired for servitude, no matter how cliche it sounds, nothing makes it more worth it than being there in that moment for somebody else.
Amen, man. And so what is it, this is so fascinating to me. What is it about, our biology, like it's in our biology to want to serve others, as you're saying, we're wired for servitude. So our brain tells us when we get a like that I think it goes something like our brain tells us that we're providing value to people because they like it. Now, where's the disconnect? Like, why isn't that fulfilling in itself? Like just having likes on Instagram, it makes us feel good for 5 minutes and then it goes away. Or by our next post, it goes away. Whereas if we do actual service for people, whether it be charity or with our business, and we're really interacting with human beings and we can see and feel the impact we're making, that can have a long-term fulfilling effect and really help us create some love for ourselves and our lives. What do you think the disconnect is?
So, I mean, I'll give you my opinion stating up front that I'm not a neurologist or a neurobiologist, but I think that because it doesn't exist in the real world. That's what I think. Like, I think that we're wired for this world now. Like, in one of the inherent problems, I think, in 2018 with technology is that we're spending so much time. Our biology has not caught up to technology. And so in a lot of ways, we're forcing it. And I think it's manifesting in some pretty problematic ways. Like, we don't exist on the internet. Our lives are happening here in the physical realm. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, when we look for validation in the realm that we don't even exist in, it's just not lasting enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super fascinating to me, man. It's a just so many amazing things about technology, and yet it's leading to so many of us being disconnected. Even those of us like myself that really focus on connection, it's just such an impediment.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm not completely against technology. I just think that we need to be mindful about how we're leveraging it to make our lives better.
Right. But the hard part is that there are a lot of the smartest people on the planet, tens of thousands of engineers whose sole job is to make these things addictive. It's very important, I think, to be aware of how much time, money, resources are going into these things being addictive, so that we can, I don't know, just be on guard a little bit. You know, be on guard when you're using social media so that you know you're not being used by it. You can just use it as a tool rather than as a, just as something to be marketed to.
Yeah. And I think we should approach everything we do in this life in that way. Like, is this something that we're using to get us to be the person that we want to be in the world, or are we becoming owned by this thing? Like, I think a lot of people should think about that before they get a mortgage, before they take a job. Like, we end up doing these things that we're told are quote unquote everyone else does or are good for us, and then it ends up taking up so much mental bandwidth that we're not even able to be the person that we want to be in the world. And, you know, I heard somebody say it at one point, but it's also just not a good look for humanity. Like, with your head down looking at your phone, I'm like, damn, that's true. It's just not a good look.
What's that? There's a movie, it's a cartoon, and everybody's buzzing around on these little, like, kind of like moped looking things, and they're all just looking at their phone. They don't even talk to each other. Have you seen that?
Yeah, Wall-E.
Yeah, dude, that's a scary movie.
Super accurate.
Scary movie. So let's talk about your ultras, man. I noticed that you got pulmonary edema at one point. This really stood out to me because my best friend got pulmonary edema. It wasn't on an ultra, but he's an ultra distance runner. So I thought it was ironic, and he almost died, man. He went into a coma for 14 days. What was the extent of the illness?
Yeah. And I will say, like, when I contracted this, like, I'm a medic. I've spent a lot of time in medicine. I've treated people for HAPE before, high altitude pulmonary edema. And so I was tracking the severity of my condition, maybe not with the brightest of minds, because I had been running for 160 miles and had been awake for days on end. But I was keeping track of it. And to the extent I realized that I could control it was, you know, I was spitting up blood. I couldn't really talk because I was, for anybody that doesn't know what happens at altitude, if you aren't accustomed to altitude sometimes, is you develop all this fluid in your lungs. And so for me, I was 80 miles into a 200-mile foot race, and I developed a ton of fluid in my lungs. And I realized as soon as I went above 7,000 feet, it would completely fill up. I couldn't talk. I could barely breathe. And if I would drop below 7,000 feet, it would clear up a little bit and I would get a little bit of relief. So it made a lot of things difficult. I couldn't lay down and sleep at aid stations like everybody else because it felt like I was drowning as soon as I laid down. I couldn't get my feet worked on because I knew if I went around the medical staff, they were going to pull me from the race. Four other people got pulled. Yeah, so it made things really difficult. And in a lot of ways, it stress tested like my biggest ideas about life. So one of the things I talked about is everything happens for you, not to you. And I had come up with that thought or learned about that thought maybe a month before this race. Now, all of a sudden, I'm at mile 87. I have 130 miles left to go in this race, and I can't even run more than 30 feet without being doubled over and spitting up blood. And so I'm like, you know, mentally, if you start getting defeated there, like it's a long way to go. The race in a 200 mile race really doesn't start until the last like 60 miles. You don't even get a ticket to the show until then.
Right.
And so I had this idea and I'm just like, why is this happening for me and not to me? And it's a very acute, you know, problem to try to stress test your ideas with. But it's one of the things I like about sport in general. It's like everything transcends, like whatever makes you better as an athlete will make you better in life and vice versa. And so I kept having this thought and I spent probably, you know, an hour trying to think through and why this could be happening for me. And all of a sudden I realized one of the things I do in all my ultra marathons is I take off too fast. And because I take off too fast, I burn out really badly in the second half of the race. And then I realized if I were to do that at 200, I'd be screwed because it's just too long. You just wouldn't make it. And so all of a sudden I realized how badly my pace had slowed. And I realized this is literally a gift. Like if it weren't for this, I would run too fast in 130 miles. Like I would be in some very serious problems. But instead, I have a problem that I can probably manage. It's going to be uncomfortable, but not as uncomfortable as quitting. And so that's why it happened for me. And that's what I mean by like when you come up with these reasons on why it happened for you, it's significant because it is your way out of this thing. And so for me, that just became my thought process. I was like, literally found so much gratitude for my lungs being filled up with fluid and spitting up blood because I realized it was going to be the thing that helped get me through to the end of this race.
It's really interesting that, yeah, you could probably find so many different reasons that that happened for you. Like another one that jumps out at me for you in this instance is that now here you are sharing this pretty important lesson about life, and it's going to go out to tens of thousands of people. Right. And then you're sharing that message. If it was just something that you read in a book or heard on a podcast, which I don't know how you learned this thought in the first place, this idea, and didn't have this experience, then you probably wouldn't be passionate enough to be sharing about it still years later. You know what I mean?
So yeah.
it really solidified in an extreme event that holy shit, this thing is true.
Yeah, completely agree. And one of the things I got from Mike Bledsoe, Barbell Shrugged, was one of the things he talks about is sometimes if he hears a thought, he will try to adopt it into his life as if he thinks it was true, just to find out if he actually resonates with it or not. And that's a good thought experiment. If you hear things that might be counterintuitive to what you already believe, it's a good way to see if you believe something else about the world. And so that's one of the things I started doing. And when I first heard this, I heard it on a podcast originally, I believe, like it just really struck out at me because I was going through some hard times. And I was like, well, let me just adopt it. Worst case, you think about it for 30 days. And worst case, you just go back to your life the way you've done shit your entire life.
Right.
And you know, no harm, no foul. Or maybe it gets you through the hardest physical thing you've ever done in your entire life and you get to talk about it forever, which was the case for me.
Right. Yeah, I let Mike try all the different things and then see him crash and burn 9 times out of 10. And then he gives me some gold every now and then.
Yeah. If you're going to push the envelope, you got to be okay with, yeah, exactly. You got to be okay with crashing sometimes, yeah. I think.
So do you have any good stories of hallucinating on your runs? I know that's pretty common and anything over like 50 miles, people will start to hallucinate.
Yeah. And you know, I'd run 12 ultras up to my first 200 miler. And when they were talking about hallucinations, I remember being like, I'm not going to hallucinate. I don't know. I mean, I've been through military training where we were up for days on end, and I'd never really experienced anything like this. And at 165 miles, like things were really starting to fall apart for me because I hadn't slept for so long because of the edema. And
did you have pacers, by the way? Did you have any support?
I did. And they saved my life. It was my girlfriend at the time and my two best friends. Yeah. And they all went through different legs with me, and going through the night was really everything. And so at about 160, 170 miles, something like that, I really started falling apart. And I looked at the plants and they kind of looked like they were lizards. And I was like, well, that's weird. They kind of like had dragon heads. And I'm like, well, that's weird. And then I'd have to get really close to them to realize that they weren't. And then I started seeing a platypus, and he would just be sitting on the side. It was like a cartoon platypus on the side of the trail. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm just going to ignore that. And then I started not realizing if I was in reality or not. I kept forgetting what I was doing because I'd fall asleep every step. And I started like really losing touch. My girlfriend was at the time the one pacing me, and she was scared of being in the woods at night. And it was like 2 a.m. And so the only thing that was like, half of my mind was trying to just completely get out of there and head into this other world. And then half of me was like holding on so tightly to reality to be like, you need to be strong for her right now because she's going to be really freaked out if you fall apart. And so literally I would see ninjas jump in front of me, like ready to fight me. And I would just hold on to my running poles in case it was real and I had to fight them. But I wouldn't say anything to her because I was like, she was behind me. And so it was just like this hours of me just fighting being in reality or not.
That is hilarious, dude.
But one of the things I love about moments like that, like, you know, it's funny to explain, but in that moment, your entire life gets reduced to nothing but forward progress. Late payments don't matter. 401ks don't matter. What you're going to do tomorrow does not matter. You've been stripped of every single thing except for trying to move forward. And I just realized like there's a lot of clarity that comes from that, like knowing that you can move forward when every single other thing is stripped away and you're in complete chaos. That's a pretty empowering, valuable lesson to take to the rest of your life.
Yeah. How do you take that into the rest of your life? What moments or times in your life is that useful?
Well, because I think that there's a lot of time, difficult times are just unavoidable in life. Like there are a lot of times where you are completely doing everything you think you're supposed to be doing, and then you just find yourself in chaos. Mm-hmm. Like whether a spouse or girlfriend, boyfriend cheats on you, or like who knows, a diagnosis. Now you have cancer, now you have whatever. And so there's been a ton of times in my own life where in the military, I've just found myself in complete catastrophe and realizing like in those moments, oh shit, I'm ready for this. You know, I remember when I was, if you have time for a super quick story, I remember when I was in Africa and I got called to go out and do this search and rescue for a plane that had gone down. And I basically got pulled out at 2 a.m. I'd taken a ton of sleeping pills, so I was like way loopy out of it. And the plane crash ended up being way further in the woods than we thought. So all I had was my med bag, a girl that was with me, and another guy. Both were sort of not special operations, but regular medics in the military, corpsmen. And one of the things that happened is we ended up going further and further into the jungle to find this plane crash than we thought we were going to have to. Originally, we thought we were just going to an airfield. And then it had been 5 hours of us low crawling through the African jungle trying to find this plane. Both of the people around me completely fell apart. The dude is like praying constantly out loud. The girl is crying. We had to low crawl because the African jungle is so thick that it was like tearing my legs up. It was completely wrecking us. And I came to this moment when I looked around. I had no idea what direction to go. He was falling apart. She was falling apart. And I was like, I'm ready for this. I've been preparing for this my whole life. Like, I am completely okay here. I know how to keep moving forward. Like, I have faith that I'm going to figure it out regardless of whether these people do or not. And to have that in your regular life is a really, really good quality, because then when things go wrong, you get to be the rock that other people count on.
Right. So that's like kind of the definition of self-esteem right there, right? You had this extreme adversity and you believed in yourself that you could cope with the situation. And it takes smaller situations on the way up to that big one to start to prove to ourselves that we can cope. So how do people develop that level of self-esteem?
I think you have to figure out ways to put your back against the wall and figure out what you're made of. I had looked, you know, I'd gone through a selection course and training, and in selection, instructors are yelling at you, you know, they're trying to make it as chaotic as possible. And when I was 19 going through, I just felt like, let me just play the game. Like, this is stupid. Like, you yell, I'll do this, whatever. And I didn't understand, you know, I was just like, let me get to the end so I can do this job. And in moments like that, though, then you look back and you realize like how important it was to test yourself, especially if you can do so in a controlled environment. And not everybody's going to be special operations, or I understand that. Not everyone's going to be in the military. But there are many, many options that are available for people to test themselves and figure out what they're made of in a more controlled environment. That way, when you're in actual catastrophe, you've already been preparing for it.
Right.
And don't wait. Like, why people would wait for that is really lost on me.
Totally.
Don't wait for your house to catch on fire.
Totally.
Get in shape now so you can get out.
Yeah, you have to get repetitions. And really, this goes all the way back to what you started talking about with goal setting. You know, one, we need goals to strive for so that we can be on a worthwhile journey. It's more about the journey than the end goal, as you say. And then that's the only way that we can give ourselves opportunities to fail and overcome failure, or experience adversity and overcome adversity, is by taking risk to actually get uncomfortable and prove to ourselves that we can cope.
Yeah. And, you know, the idea of failure holds a lot of people back, but you just have to figure out a way to reframe it, to realize like, it's just the process. The goal is not about the goal. The goal is about the process. So if you look at it in that way, you can reframe failure as, what did I learn from this? Like, businesses fail. You're going to be okay. But did you learn? Is there something that you can take so you can double down next time moving forward and have a better chance at success?
Right. So a couple other things from your first book, the bucket list blueprint.
Yeah.
How do you know exactly? Actually, first explain this a little bit. What is this?
So the bucket list blueprint was this way that I realized that I had been doing things in life that a lot of people were like, well, that's pretty big. Like, you're going to run 200 miles, you're going to whatever. But I realized I didn't start that way. And so I was trying to deduce how I actually got to this point where I was special operations and running these long races and writing books and stuff like that. And so the bucket list blueprint is that the way that I figured out how I go about doing these bigger things. And I think the most important takeaway from the entire blueprint is the beginning is called the art of the low risk probe, which is just figuring out what is the minimum barrier to entry that you could do in order to test out whether you actually like that thing. Because a lot of times we do something or we want to do something, but the reality is we only like the idea of it. And if we were to actually do it, we'd realize we didn't want to. And so when you find a low risk probe, it's like, what is the minimum amount of time, a minimum amount of money that you can like stress test this idea and see if you like it. So, you know, one of the stories I give in the book is this idea that growing up, I always wanted to be a rock star, like everybody, a lot of kids do. Well, I played in a band, and that's a low risk probe. I got to play all around Virginia Beach, and we had a song on the radio, and I got to like do these things, but also realize I hate that industry. And figuring out what you don't want to do is actually in a lot of ways just as important as figuring out what you do want to do, because it's no longer taking up mental bandwidth. So at the end of the day, I think everybody has a bucket list. There's something somewhere something you want to do, whether it's you've written it down or not. Maybe you should. I think you should. And then just start figuring out what is your low risk probe to start testing these ideas and these things that you might want to do in life. And I think as you go through this process, you find things that don't resonate with you, which is what I was talking about, or you find that you align with something. And then you realize to get to the real thing, you're going to have to level up in order to go through that process. And so that's the importance of having a bucket list. And that sort of falls back into line. Like, then you can pick goals around your bucket list. But I just think it's a good place to start for most people because they don't actually know where to start.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a great metaphor for being clear about who we are in general, not only like what we want to do, but who we are, is finding out who we are not, or what we don't want to do. It's like just peeling back layers of the onion until we get closer and closer and closer to our core and our center of who we are and what we want to do. One of the most common low risk probes, and I learned this from you, the low risk probe, but I didn't realize that I had been recommending this to people for years, is if you want to be a strength and conditioning coach, you want to be a fitness professional, anything of the sort, go and volunteer at a CrossFit gym, go and volunteer at a college strength and conditioning program where people are actually busting their asses. And the most common thing I'll see is people want to be a college or professional strength and conditioning coach. They go spend 2 weeks with that community and they're like, I don't want half of that.
Those
are some hard working sons of bitches. And they, you know, they don't really want it.
Yeah. Right. It's like, you know, Thoreau has that quote that's often probably misrepresented and quoted a lot, but it's, most men lead lives of quiet desperation.
Yes.
Well, if you were to figure out that most of the things that you're desperately wanting to do, you actually only like the idea of and don't want to do, that would be a pretty freeing process for most people.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about your second book. I know it's kind of an extension of the first. Tell us more about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the point of the second book was, like I told you, I had gone through this year on paper was the most successful year of my life. And I looked around and I realized I was completely miserable. And so I hadn't yet gotten it right. Even though I was exploring and leveling up and following all of these habits, doing all of the quote unquote professional development things I was supposed to do, And I was like, well, why am I still miserable? Why do I still feel like disconnected from my own life? And it came down to this idea that I didn't actually know who the hell I was or what I wanted. I was just doing things because I wanted to be the guy that did things, because I wanted to, I cared much more about the achievement than the process. And so this book is about figuring out who you are first before you find yourself in those moments of chaos, because it gives you a lot more direction in life. And you'll find the things, you know, I talked about my talk that's finding a worthy struggle. It's the same idea. You need to find a struggle that aligns. We're not getting out of struggle in this life. Right. So find one that aligns with who you want to be and what you really want in life. And then you are able to navigate the chaos much better.
Yeah, it's like either we have the struggle of a worthwhile goal or the struggle of not being on a worthwhile goal or worthwhile journey.
Yeah.
Which like, one is more painful?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're not getting out of this without pain. Right. A couple of years ago, this is probably a good example for the whole thing. But a couple of years ago, I was snowboarding on a trip and I was at the bar and I was talking to the bartender and he was like, hey, do you mind if I get out of here for a couple of minutes? I'll be right back. He came back and I was like, oh, what's up? He's like, oh, I just had to take a Percocet. I can't stand for more than 4 hours. And I was like, in that moment, you know, when I started ultra running, all these people are like, oh, what about your knees? Like same thing when you start squatting heavy and you start lifting a lot. And people are like, they're worried about your health when you're taking on these healthy endeavors for some reason. And I just realized in that moment, like, oh, I'm just picking my pain. I'm going to find it on its own terms. I'm going out and finding the pain in the mountains. I'm running from Friday to Sunday. I'm getting pain there, but I'll never have to take a Percocet to stand for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so a lot of ways, like we're not getting out of this life, like I said, without struggle, without pain, and it can happen at any moment. And so in my opinion, you gotta find the places, you gotta find a worthy struggle so you can put yourself in those positions so you can test yourself. And then you get to live life on your own terms. It's not happening to you anymore. You're not at the mercy of a pill so that you can stand for a couple hours, which is probably the biggest tragedy of the whole thing.
Yeah, man, that's a powerful message, dude. And you're doing that. I think you're writing some of this book on a long backpacking trip. Is that right?
Yeah. Like, you know, I told you, I stress test all of my ideas. And one of the ideas that I have is, you know, if you've been given this message, your job above everything else is to pursue it. And so I sometimes just trust that the path is going to appear. And so far I haven't been wrong. And so, I'm going away. I'm going to Australia to go backpacking and I'm not allowing myself to come back until I finish the book.
Wow. Cool. Yeah. Cool. And so are you going to be basically backpacking and camping the entire time or how, what are you doing?
I'm doing a couple different things. There's a couple places I want to visit. I am making writing the chief sort of thing I'm doing there. So I'm not spending a ton of time adventuring. But I found this thing called Workaway. So I'm going to go work at a yoga studio and they're going to let me live there for free. And so I got to work a couple hours a day in the afternoons and in the mornings I'm going to write. And that just felt like a good way to find clarity because I'll be doing so much meditation and yoga.
That is super cool, man. Super cool. Yeah. And it's such a great, some language I just picked up recently is this term called inevitability thinking. And so if you want to do something in your life, you can make it inevitable more or less by creating some external constraints. And so with me, one thing I want to do every day, I've committed to spending an hour a day working on becoming a world-class personal development coach. That's something I deeply, deeply want to do. And so if I don't spend an hour every day, if I miss a day, I have to eat 10 cheeseburgers and 6 ice creams, which, you know, I might like 3 cheeseburgers and an ice cream, but 10 and 6, I absolutely don't want to go there.
Sounds right? So awful.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, yours is similar. It's not a consequence, but it's an external constraint that makes it almost inevitable that you're going to succeed. And I'm sure you listen to a little Jordan Peterson, right?
Very much so.
Okay. So yeah. Jordan Peterson, one of the things I love that he says is we want a worthwhile goal to strive towards, but we also want things that we're running away from, like a lesser version of ourselves or some kind of like consequence. So
yeah,
I love that, dude. That's cool.
Yeah. So his theory on motivation or one of the ways he explains it, I actually really love. I took his future authoring course and I think, you know, man, we are in a motivation culture and there is some garbage out there about, you know, motivational memes and whatever. And I try not to get too caught up in those because I do think they're so, I don't know, just sort of or overdone, I guess.
Sure.
But one of the things that he does in the future authoring course is he talks about, okay, this is your ideal life. So you list out things like I talked about. And then he's like, but then he has you list out what your life is going to look like if you don't do all of the things that you know you need to do.
Yes.
And that is such a more motivating thing, because sometimes we don't want to go to the gym in the morning, or we don't want to spend an hour working on professional development. But if you follow that thread and see where that goes, you're going to be like, I do not want to go there. And for me, that's been a really powerful motivator.
Hell yeah, man. And it doesn't, like, where we could go, it might not be as bad as like we end up on the streets and we're druggy or something like obviously terrible. What's way more likely is that we live a life in quiet desperation, or we live a life of complacency, or a life of boredom, or a life with bad relationships or mediocre relationships. That is just so possible if we don't go through life consciously and persistently working towards worthwhile goals.
Yeah. And, you know, people that listen to podcasts or are listening to this are most likely growth minded. And if you're growth minded, one of the things that you absolutely would not be able to stand is to know that you've lived your life as a lesser version of who you could be. And that, to me, is just very motivating.
Hell yeah, man. Dude, this has been phenomenal. We went deep, and I appreciate you being open and being vulnerable with sharing some of your stories, man. Where can people keep up with you personally? And then where can they get updates on when you release that next book?
So probably on Instagram, as much as I just railed against it for an hour, at @RickAlexander_. I talk about a lot of these ideas on my own radio show, Lionheart Radio. And then if you're interested in the book, which is sort of the chief way that I'm making money at the moment, it's burnyourcouch.com, and it'll bring you to buy it.
Sweet, man. Thank you so much, dude. Talk soon.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.